This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 15th of August, 1951. The title of this lecture is Self-Analysis. This tape is 55 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Good evening. I want you to pay very close attention to the lecture tonight. Very close attention. I'm going to give you a talk on how you talk about the tone scale to people who don't know anything about Dianetics. I will probably use Dianetic terminology to a marked degree, but with enough double talk in betwixt and so forth to make it comprehensible. This lecture, if my somewhat exhausted brains will let me do it, to try to make this a tape model description from which can be extrapolated a course on human evaluation. When I say my somewhat depleted and dilapidated brains, I don't happen to be joking. In the past week, I've turned out a book, and I didn't realize this till yesterday, and I went into a near state of shock, realizing that I had been working on it just a little bit over a week. And I didn't really realize it today when the linotype operator had been keeping up with me. And the book is practically sliding off of the presses at this moment, and it was only started a few days ago. This speed is something that doesn't happen very often. I want to give you a little local news on this book, by the way. This book is self-analysis. It contains tone scale charts by which a person can put himself on the tone scale if he's dumb enough to do so. But there's still an out. It still depends in these tests on his judgment so that he can still welch out of it. And it contains about 1,000 questions in various categories and types of validation, messed, straight wire, which resolve valence problems in validation cases, occluded cases, and even resolves cases that are afraid of the weather. This very interesting conglomeration of questions, of course, are designed to strike straight home to the lowest level of aberration on the analytical plane. And I had an awful time dictating these questions. I had a formula set up, and I was just reading off this formula and so on, and all of a sudden I'd go out of present time, and then I'd come back up to present time, and I'd dictate a few more questions. I'd figure out, and I'd find my... I all of a sudden discovered that I'd been sitting at the desk for 5 minutes doing nothing. You know, I'd get back up to present time and go on with my work. So I took the platters on the soundscriber down to... Or Don picked them up and took them down to his girl at the office. She took the things off of the platter, and the first day, I think she was awfully groggy, and the second day, didn't she have to go home at noon? She was really skidding out of present time. Well, now you know very well that a linotype operator, at the moment he embraced his profession, ceased to be a human being, and became a candidate for a science fiction rabbit. They sit there with copy of all sorts and descriptions, and it just very rhythmically bobbity 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 bop, and for copy, turn it over and bobbity bop. I know how these people are because I have written deathless prose. In my youth, I wrote deathless prose, and have seen it go into a magazine printing office, and I've seen it on the linotype. And this was the stuff that was supposed to exhilarate, you know, and petrify the reader and fill him full of chills and all that sort of thing. And linotype operator sitting there, bobbity, 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 bobbity. And kid-like, you know, I'd say, how do you like the story? What story? It was very hard on my ego. Fortunately, the ego of youth heals. I've gotten to a point now where I don't even expect linotype operators to emote. But we got one who did. This copy comes off of the platters. It goes over to the linotype at Wichita Publishing. And there's a chap there who's deaf and dumb, who is noted for his unemotionalism. And I went down there today, and I said to the owner of the place, by the way, yesterday, did you have any trouble yesterday with your linotype operator? How'd you know? I said, well, just tell me, did you have any trouble? Well, yes, all day. I went around and I asked Bill and Jim and so forth, is he sick? And we have a boy here in the shop that talks with the hands with him, and I asked him to go over and ask him if it was all right, if he was all right. And you know, last week I raised his pay 25 cents an hour. Well, what happened? Well, he slowed down. I mean, he just wasn't doing anything. To prove to me how bad off the linotype operator was, he took me around and introduced me to each member of his printing team and asked each member, now, what did I ask you yesterday about the linotype operator, machine number 2? Well, yeah, you were worried about him all day. This fellow had been coasting out of present time on these questions, you know, bobby, bob, bob. Now, all of a sudden, bobby, 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 bob, and stop. And then, all of a sudden, get up from the chair, walk around very agitated, smoke a cigarette, just light it, put it out, sit down again, you know, determinedly. It cost Wichita Publishing a young fortune to get out that day's work yesterday. So, before this happened, however, Ross and I were discussing it, and he says, wait till we find out what happens to the linotype operator. If they do anything to the linotype operator, God help the reader. Well, this material is evidently coming off the press about Tuesday, Monday or Tuesday. You shouldn't confuse this material, by the way, with self-auditing. Actually, it's the author is auditing the preprint, and there isn't anything very confusing about it except the price of the book. I first decided that this book would probably be put out for $2.75, and then I was reading how Elbert Hubbard used to publish, and I was not slow to take a tip from him. He said, you have to have even money. So I said, can we put out this book for $2? And Don says, yes. And I thought we were all in agreement on this. So I write a letter out to the field, all the HDAs in the field, and tell them this book is available for $2. But he's got one in the mails already that says it's for $2.50. Well, that's, I hope, is going to be the most confusing thing about it. I really couldn't say what happens with this book. I've been turning on some perceptics and making people nervous and so forth with it. Very interesting. But get on with the lecture for tonight. It is often incumbent upon one to try to explain Dynex. He sits down, he's feeling comfortable, he's at peace with the world. He's sitting there in a restaurant drinking a cup of coffee. And he's got a book under his arm. The fellow comes down and he says, you know, I've heard about this Dianetics. This stranger says, I heard about this Dianetics. That's what's curing the new penicillins, isn't it? And the fellow says, no. No. All the fellow says is something about a diet. He says, no. As a matter of fact, it has to do with the mind. Oh, psychiatry. In short, it's rather difficult. Well, I found a way to short-circuit this whole thing. I don't try to explain to them about engrams, secondaries, how crazy they are. Usually winds up from a peaceful frame of mind to practically a battle of insults if you go about it. So I quite by accident found out that if you just explained it on the basis of it's some new scientific research and you know what they've got over there? I'm usually anonymous in these conversations. You know what they've got over there? They've got a tone scale. And it's a funny darn thing, but it tells how people behave. And if people at certain levels on this tone scale, and if they're a certain level on this tone scale, then they behave a certain way, and you predict how people behave. And I haven't yet found somebody who didn't alert to this data. And they say, yes, I wonder where I am on it. Inevitable response. Short circuit the whole thing right there. We don't have to go into psychiatry. I don't have to tell them about electric shock. I don't have to tell them how Dianetics is not hypnotism. But in short, it saves so many words. There's a new tone scale, and you can predict a person's behavior on it. Gee, I wonder where I am on that tone scale. Simple. Then you can drink your cup of coffee and leave. So, in the interest of that, as well as in the interest of the class which is being conducted here on this subject, I want to tell you a quick one about this tone scale. The word tone is one which is not misunderstood in society. People know about high-toned individuals, and they know about people who are low, and They know that the word tonic is derived from tone. If they don't, they rather sense it. And in short, there's a lot of derivations for this tone. It sort of sounds musical. And when you say tone scale, levels of human behavior, you get some amount of agreement on it. Now, if you're teaching an elementary class in this subject, all you have to do is draw three lines, and you say, well, it's like this. You ever meet a guy who was about half dead? They say, yeah, as a matter of fact, yeah. That reminds me of my father or something. Sorry. And you say, well, about half dead, huh? Well, he's right there. And they say, well, why is he right there? Well, you see, everybody below this thing, They're pretty dead. Everybody above this thing, they're pretty alive. Well, that's sensible. You mean you got a scale there that says how dead people are and how alive they are. That's exactly it. How dead they are and how alive they are. And if they're only this far up, why, they're just that much alive and that much dead, you might say. But if they're up here, why, they're all that way to death, and they're obviously that much alive, and they're that much dead. Now you put it another way, you say, but of course, you know, we're not talking about how half-dead people are. We're actually talking about how conscious they are. You realize that a person thinks as well as he is conscious. A person who is conscious thinks. People who are unconscious don't think. And you get agreement on that. And you say, well, this is a person at this level on this graph is half-conscious. His analytical attenuation has set into a point where his analyzer has shut down to 2.0 on the tone scale. And you don't tell him those last few words, because that'll confuse him. You just say he's half conscious. Here he's all the way conscious, and there he's completely unconscious. He's dead. Now that's the tone scale. Dead, quarter conscious, half conscious, three quarters conscious, conscious. Now, you can say up here, this level of consciousness is practically unheard of. Nearly everybody is just a little bit unconscious, the society being what it is, and people who have been in the service particularly, reading bulletins and things like that, they get down the tone scale. And so the society runs, if we're very charitable, the society runs someplace between there and there, probably. Personally, I believe it runs about there, but... here and here. That's be about the average man, all right? Now, if a person is just so much conscious, you wouldn't expect a person who was only half conscious to have a good reaction if you were driving a car, would you?
No. Well, he doesn't have. And you take a person who's only half conscious and put him behind the wheel of a car and send him off down the street, you know, average driver. crash. Well, that's what happens. And so if he'll break up a car, what else will he break up? Because he's only half conscious. See, because he isn't thinking well. If he isn't thinking well, then he doesn't react right. His wife says, "Dear, how are you tonight?" And he says, "Don't swear at me, you hussy." You know, he's only half conscious. He's not hearing right, not putting it back out the way he should be. So he gets into lots of trouble when he's only half conscious, because he looks down the street and he sees a Great Dane walking down the street, and he's being only half conscious, he doesn't see any Great Dane there, so he falls over the Great Dane and breaks his wrist. In other words, the fellow has a certain amount of liability in the society if he's going around in that state. Well, now, if he were fully conscious, he'd see the Great Dane. And if he were really fully conscious, he might not only see the Great Dane, but he might say hello to the Great Dane. If the Great Dane were fully conscious, too, he would probably say hello. But supposing the Great Dane were only half conscious, and this fellow's fully conscious, and he sees the Great Dane, and he says to the Great Dane, "Hello," and the Great Dane says, "Rrr," and there we got the Great Dane. See, the Great Dane mistakes a kind word and answers with antagonism, and you know that's where that is on the tone scale. That's antagonism. Now, that's being half conscious. Now, if an individual gets much less than half conscious, well, what happens to a fellow if you put a quart of rye in his brisket and send him off down the road in the car? That's a pretty good risk not to be insured. He'll get down the road just about so far, and he's liable to drive too fast and so on. But what's a fellow do when he's only, let's say, a little over a quarter conscious and something goes wrong in his vicinity? Well, he has an interesting reaction. He gets mad. He gets very angry, as a matter of fact. You can throw a curve in of explanation here and say, well, you know, our psychologist has proven. And psychologists really did prove this. This was something they really proved. That if you take a dog and cut out half of his brain, the only emotion that he will show because of this is rage. Dogs don't like to have half their brains cut out. They proved this. As a matter of fact, that is the emotion there when consciousness is cut down into this strata. Rage, anger, destruction, so on. And if a person gets down here, though, he's so unconscious he can't even find something to get mad about. He's very... Down here he's confused about what he's going to get mad about, and he doesn't get mad, but down below here he's too dead. He's too far off. He isn't going to get mad at all. He's down in here, he might cry, but that's about all. But you get up into this upper bracket up here, the tone scale, and you find that he's pretty conscious, he's pretty alert, he's on the ball, he's on the key beat, he's the kind of fellow you wish you could on. Now, so much for the tone scale. Let's derive the tone scale another way. Derive it another way. A child gets born. Now, the mood of an animal or a human being and so forth is not dependent so much on its capability. A child a few weeks old or a few months old is not very capable, but the child's mood's pretty good shape and its survival potential's pretty good. And he's happy, cheerful, happy, nothing much worries him. As a matter of fact, if you ever watched a child a few months old watching a quarrel in his vicinity, he hasn't got enough sense to be worried about it. He laughs. Then, of course, one of the parents gets mad, probably hits him over the head with a brick bat or something. And after that, he finds out that when they quarrel, he gets hit over the head with a brick bat, so that isn't something you laugh about. But his troubles have started. But before his troubles start, I don't mean to postulate that all American homes are this brutal, just most of them. I look at the number of divorces which are listed in the papers and see the extraordinary things that go on. And I can't find out if there are any marriages left in America. I'm going to have Gallup look this up and find out if there are any marriages left in America. Well, here's the child. He's been born. He's got over with that and so forth. But we'll start him out at a few months of age. And there he is, happy and gurgling in his crib and a little fool. Boy, think of what'll happen to this kid. When he gets to be five, they'll say, now the thing for you to do is to be educated. So for years, he will walk in and out of the schoolroom. Well, then he's going to get to be about 18, and they've long since passed a bill which will have universal military training. So he will go into the Army. And we'll probably be at war at that time with North Saskatchewan or something of the sort. So he'll spend his year or two in the Army. And when he gets out, he'll be willing to start out in life finally and maybe finish up his college education. But just about the time he's got one foot up on the rung and he's just about to ascend the ladder and amount to something, he gets married. And then think of his wife's parents. They didn't approve of him in the first place. He kept her out to 4 o'clock every night, didn't they? And they knew that was for no good. Of course, he'd married her, but they knew he'd never amount to anything. I told her so frequently, and she begins to believe it, too. But he still gets over the hump all right, and then it'd be perfectly all right to have children unless one had them in a country which doesn't reduce your taxes enough to worry about if you have children, and which puts rather high penalty on fatherhood and childhood and so forth. It's very taxable. It makes it possible for the society to nail a fellow down very closely. Well, he was going to change to another job, but now he's got little Duncan, and he said, well, I'll pay off the hospital bills. Here I am working down here at this garage. It's not a good job, but I don't dare quit because I have to pay off these hospital bills. And he just about gets little Duncan's hospital bills paid off when there's Esmeralda, and that's the end of him. Then he gets to be 35, and they've made him an executive down at the garage so that he could get ulcers. And finally, he's got a salary now that'll really support all of his penchants. He can go out and raise the dickens if he wants to, but that's the catch, if he wants to. He's too tired now, so he just wanes on off, and you can expect him, if he's an executive, you can expect him to live 5 or 6 more years. If he's a laborer, you expect him to live another 50, of course. Anyway, that's the course of this fellow's life. So here he is. He's going along just fine here. He's having a good time, and then he gets into kindergarten, and he goes to school, and he's getting older all this time. But, of course, all this is being nicely canceled by the fact that he's growing up. Otherwise, it'd probably be a much sharper decline. But he has the goal before him of growing up. Just why he wants to be an adult, we're not sure. But he wants to be. I wonder who sells kids on this. Anyhow, here he is, light as a feather, happy as a clam, dewdrops on the rose bushes every morning. He gets up, life's wonderful and worth living, and he's trying to be an adult. All right, down the way he goes, and this is the point where he gets about to the 8th grade, and there he's getting to high school now, and about this point he found out that he's found out how much smarter he is than his parents. And it's just down the line here a little bit when he finds out how much his parents have learned in the last 5 years. So here's where he goes into the Army. And here's where he gets married. Then his life goes on more or less uneventfully. And he reaches the prime of life here. And then he gets into old age. The graph of a human being. Well, here's 4. Here's 2. There's where they buried him. Now, what happened was, boy, he was up there 4-0. Life's happy. Life's wonderful. Life's beautiful. Very alert. Car come along, he dodges. Dog barks at him, he barks back. Here he is. All right. Now, when he starts to get educated, here he goes down the line. Well, he gets to here 3-0. He's all right. He's doing all right. He has his problems, but He's still pretty hard to suppress. Life starts pushing him very hard, and he sure pushes back. And when he gets down here, he's still got a lot of get up and go when he gets into the Army. But after he gets out, he's just in a mood of antagonism. He doesn't antagonize very much, but he antagonizes all the time, let's say. You know, he sort of feels antagonistic toward life. It sort of put something off on him that he didn't expect. And he sort of fights back at it. He thinks something is wrong. He thinks the society ought to be organized a little bit better. He thinks that those old men on Capitol Hill didn't have a right to pass a bill which would never include them. They had immunity anyhow, despite their age and everything, and he gets to worrying about things like this. He decides that the government should be changed, and he decides a lot of things. But this is the point where he crosses 2.0, and he's coasting down now. By the time he gets down here, he's just mad. He doesn't know what he's mad about, but he's mad. This is about the time his wife's parents have assured her for the 15th time that she really should, in spite of the sort of a fellow he was, stay with him because it was the thing to do. And they've told him that he could keep little Duncan if he went on with his job, and they had a family conference, and he figured out human beings didn't have this much right to tell him what to do, but all he could do about it was get mad. And when he got awfully mad about it, they made him terribly ashamed, and the madder he got, the more ashamed they made him, so they finally drove him down here. And he's getting down there around 1 now, and here physiologically he starts to fail. And that's about the end of that. Well, that's the tone scale. That's the tone scale from the standpoint of age. Now, let's take this graph again. Let's take this graph again from another standpoint. We know something about the goal of existence being survival. We don't have to argue about it. There are a lot of people that are trying to survive. Some aren't, but a lot of people are. And they would have some hope for the future and so forth. And let's take the modus operandi of survival. Survival depends on having something to help you survive and not having something that won't help you to survive. That's so elementary. A non-survival item must be absent. And a pro-survival item must be present. In other words, the fellow's got to have food and got to have his mother-in-law in the next town if possible. He's got this situation whereby all of this stuff that is going to inhibit his survival, that he knows is going to inhibit his survival, has got to be away from him. Seriously inhibit his survival. Newspaper headlines, he keeps this stuff well away from him. And he's got to have food, clothing, and shelter, pro-survival items, near him. Some people include the marital partner. Pro-survival items. Now, that's the way his life is arranged. When you try to turn his life around, what happens to him when you insist that he accept something that he considers to be a non-survival item? You come in to tell this fellow and you say, you know, we just have turned over Wichita. Wichita has just come under the new Fourth International Communist Regime. This is what I'm talking about in the far distant future, 1965, something of the sort. And did you read 1984? Boy, that's certainly a beautiful book. Anyway, so the commissar for the block comes in and says to him, "What? You aren't living with your mother-in-law? Well, I'm sending your mother-in-law a set of orders, and she's going to move in with you." Now, he considers this a non-survival action. What is his emotional response? Well, of course, at 1965, he'd be so beaten down, he won't have an emotional response. So we'll take it today. Supposing you went in and ordered a fellow to accept a non-survival item. He had to accept it. That was all there was to it. What would be his reaction? Supposing you tried to take away from him what he considered to be a pro-survival item. Like you said, "I'm not going to take away from you the right to eat beefsteak. You're not going to have any more beefsteak." What's his reaction? Well, these actions are best studied not in an adult, but in a child. These are not necessarily the reactions of a child. They're the reactions of anyone. But adults become a little more fixed in their reaction. Their reactions have turned out to be pattern reactions, and a child, even a fairly aberrated child, is still very fluid in his reactions. He responds quickly. The joys and griefs of childhood follow each other with such rapid succession that Mama has no more than walked into the house feeling terribly sorry for little Oscar, who has just lost his last friend, and she's done her best to cheer him up, and she goes into the house thinking how poor little fella, and wasn't he sweet? And he's sitting in somehow or other, he got in the house before she was, he's sitting there, and he's licking the cake bowl, and he looks at her, and he smiles happily, and so forth. But the child's life, emotionally, is a sort of a roller coaster. Zing, zing, zing. And they react rapidly. So it's very interesting to watch a child when he is being denied something that he considers pro-survival. Let's say he's being denied something. He considers that this item is vital to his survival. You know, a nickel for a candy bar. Well, when a child wants something, he wants it. With violence, I mean, there's no question in his mind about it. So he comes around to Mom and he says, Mama, he says, he's happy, smiling, cheerful. He says, Mama, can I have a nickel? And Mama looks at him and says, no, what did you do with your allowance? I gave you a nickel yesterday. You should learn to be careful with money. How am I ever going to teach you to be careful with money? You know, more extraneous data. What he wants is a nickel. So he says, he says to her, I want a nickel. And Mama says, you mustn't talk to me that way. After all, I am your mother, and other extraneous data. He wants a nickel. So he says, yeah, yeah, yeah. He may even lie down on the floor and kick his heels against the floor, you know, tantrum. He's angry about the whole thing. And Mama says, you get right up from there. Hey, young man, I'll disown you. See, she's really going to fix him now. She'll just take this rest of this thing and she'll shut him down the rest of the line quick into apathy. And she'll shake him out of the tantrum. If he still wants the nickel, he will say, well, really, I wanted to buy a nickel for Jimmy Jones because he broke his leg. It's a lie. He broke his leg, and actually, he's lying down in the gutter now, and I said I'd get a nickel and get an ice cream cone, and that would make him happy. Children learn to be skillful liars by trial and error. And he's unable to make the grade there. So his next response is tears. And he still doesn't get the nickel. So his last response is, I don't want it. I wouldn't take a nickel. I don't want anything to do with this nickel. Nickels, I don't know anything about nickels. Dickens with it. There's your tone scale reaction on an acceptance, the effort to obtain something desirable that he considers survival. Happy, maybe not quite so happy, but serious. Antagonistic, angry, deceitful, grief, apathy, doesn't want it. Now let's go the other way around. The child we're talking about has his trials. I'm sure no child has trials of this character. He has to eat his cereal. Now, Willie, you're going to eat your cereal. Willie, why don't you eat your cereal? And he says, I don't want any cereal. And this seems reasonable to him. It shouldn't need all these appendices and footnotes and so forth. I don't want any cereal. Willie, you've got to eat your cereal. Well, if the cereal is pushed off on him, it'll go along the cycle of first, he will say, no, I don't want any cereal. And then he will say, I don't want any cereal. And then he'll say, he doesn't want any cereal. And then he'll say, but I have a stomachache. Now he's got a good reason. But if that doesn't fool him, why, the cereal is being spooned into his mouth by this time, and he is crying and blubbering and so forth, but he's still swallowing the cereal. But whoever's feeding him shouldn't get cocky with victory at that time, because just one little more push down the line will break the kid into a point where he will sit there dry-eyed and he'll eat the cereal and grow up just that much so that as an adult he will patronize cafeterias, so forth. That's the way the society trains people to use the restaurants, the kind of restaurants you see around on the streets. They break them down into apathy about food, and then they'll eat anything. Now, this is your reverse scale. Now, you see, when you try to thrust something off on a person he doesn't want, or if a person's threatened by something, so that's all non-survival. This bring this Great Dane into the act again. The Great Dane runs up to the child, and if the Great Dane is actually a threat to the child, the child's responses go somewhat in this fashion. First thing you know, he looks up the street and he sees the Great Dane, and he says, "A doggie." And the Great Dane takes a look at him, and the Great Dane, you remember, is we left him at 2.0. He's antagonistic. So he says, "Call me a doggy, will you?" And he comes up with the kid and he says, "Grr." And the kid says, "You go away." And then the Great Dane comes closer and he says, "You go away." And the Great Dane comes closer and the kid gets mad now. He may get crying mad, but he gets mad. He's angry at the Great Dane. If he could get his hands on the Great Dane, if he were big enough, if the Great Dane were smaller, he would destroy the Great Dane at this point. But as the Great Dane advances nearer and nearer to him, he discovers the enormity of this Great Dane. And he discovers that the Great Dane is too close, the Great Dane is antagonistic, and the Great Dane is something to be frightened of. So from anger, he goes into fear. And from fear, he goes into grief. He will cry if he can't get rid of the Great Dane. And if he cries and the Great Dane still stands over him and snarls and so forth, the kid will just lie there in ash and apathy. He's given up. Actually, what he's doing is pretending he's dead. Because it's well known that Great Danes do not eat dead children. There are animals that have this as a built-in mechanism. This is a standard routine. The built-in mechanism is pretended death. A possum, so forth, playing possum. So, on being threatened with danger, you go right down the line, the danger is a long way away. And as long as a fellow is safe from danger, he'd just as soon laugh at it. I've never seen anybody so cocky in my life as an admiral sitting on a shore station. Happy, cheerful fellows. Knew an admiral's aide once that went down this tone scale faster than anybody ever saw go down the tone scale. He'd been sitting there the night before at the officers' club. He had been telling three of us how what a cush job he had and what a lot of suckers we were. And he was really rubbing it in. You could just see him licking his chops. He was actually splashing saliva back over both ears as he licked his chops. Well, he forgot one thing. We were short of officers. And he told us that he already had three men trained to do his work. The operations office was open that night at 2:00. They received a visit. This fellow the next morning was presented his set of orders. He was sitting there, happy, laughing, cheerful. World was going on, and he got this slip of paper. A little bit alert, you know. He wasn't quite as happy with a piece of paper in his hand. He opens it up, and he sees his name, and he's not anywhere near as happy by that time. He sees it says orders. It says from, to, via, subject, enclosures, references, one. Boy, have I got a memory. Anyway, it says, you will report aboard the USS Blank as soon as possible to take the post of engineering officer. You are hereby considered, and it says signature, and then dot, dot, dot across the page. First endorsement, you are hereby detached. Well, it was all right as long as he reads the orders. Now he could be just sort of antagonistic about this whole thing, because there was some chance of getting out of it. The admiral hadn't seen it, but then on the last part of the page it says, You are detached, and there's the admiral's signature. Well, he went down the line angry, and then you could see the guy quiver a little bit, and then he sort of wonders to himself, he sort of sorrowed for a moment over the old happy days, a slight glimmer of a tear in the eye, and then he sunk into complete apathy, got up, picked up his cap, shoveled the rest of the stuff into the bag, and walked on down, pretending he wasn't dangerous, pretending he was dead, walked on board the ship and went out and joined the amphibious forces. Now, there's your cycle again. Person receiving news, the person himself being removed from one point to another. Now, it's a funny thing, that isn't it a strange thing? You've watched people react. You know that they follow a sort of a cycle. And as you think on it, you realize that there is a sort of a pattern cycle in this sort of thing. A person doesn't lie unless he's afraid. A person has to be afraid to lie, unless he's just romancing. A person who is angry is very destructive. He's fighting something, and you know the irrationality of an angry man. Nobody ever really saw a nice, rational, angry man. You can watch these manifestations, and you know what the common phrase is when we talk about grief. Oh, I wish I were dead, is the standard phraseology. Here again, we have the same thing. Anger is non-survival, but it's better to fight than not to fight at all. Being afraid is definitely non-survival. Grief is a recognition of the fact that some non-survival is going inevitably on, but apathy is the acceptance of this non-survival situation. Now, the pretended death is nothing more or less than accepted death. Up above this line, a person gets more and more alive, and what is the synonym for being happy and cheerful? He went up the line. The happier a person is, the more alive he feels, and so on. So life goes in this cycle, emotion goes in this cycle, and so forth. We take this and divide it off. We find the standard reactions of individuals for these various moods. Let's take truth. Let's just take truth. How do people handle truth? Now, a person up here is liable to give a lot of creative imagination. It's very, a lot of verb, creative imagination. But that's not untruth, is it? It's postulating a future. A creative imagination is trying to figure out a future. If a person has a lot of survival potential, this person feels that there's a future to dream about. When he gets down the tone scale a ways, he doesn't have as much future, and he doesn't do as much dreaming. But here's this fellow at the top, but he'll tell the truth. There's truthfulness. Down here, he tells the truth just enough. See, he isn't quite as alive there, so he isn't quite as active. So he tempers the truth with a little conservatism. He believes something is completely true. Up here he will say, yes, I believe cats have 9 lives. But here he'll say, it is commonly believed in science and has many times been investigated by the professor of psychology at the University of Illinois that cats possess, it is said, 9 lives. Now, he's made an acceptable scientific utterance when he has said that. And so this is the conservative truth. Now, we know that a person, when he gets antagonistic, we've gotten this, Brian, now, when he gets antagonistic toward life in general, what's your observation? Is that fellow tell the truth about, doesn't he sometimes look for an excuse to get angry a little bit? He looks around. He tries to pick a fight. He says, what's the idea of having done so-and-so and so-and-so? But somebody didn't do that. In other words, he embroiders it a little bit. So here we're starting to get some lying. Well, anger lies here. And now let's take the angriest man you've probably listened to, and that is a fellow by the name of, well, the late Herr Schickelgruber of Germany and other European points. In other words, Hitler. Now, Hitler was an angry man. He talked in a lot of anger. It was a very funny thing that he never seemed to tell much truth. As a matter of fact, in quarrels, have you ever seen a person who was very angry? Have you ever seen him tell the truth? I'm afraid you haven't. He seems to be that when anger, when you get to a point of anger, the truth seems to be something that is avoided, and one goes on saying things about which to be angry, whether they're true or not. In other words, here's quite a departure from the truth. And would you trust a person who was afraid? That's the next step down. Would you trust a person who was afraid to tell the truth? You say, Mr. Dumb John, would you jump down there? I think some shells are loose in the magazine. Would you jump down there and take a look around and see if you can't get them secured up and so forth? And, well, tell me if there are some shells in the magazine in the first place. And you turn your back and you walk over to the other end of the bridge, and he's back with you in about 10 minutes. And he says, well, they're all secured, sir. Only you know he's very a frightened fellow of shells. He didn't want to go into that magazine, so he gave you a report. Fear made him tell you a lie. All right. Social lying is the fear of social consequences. So on. Fear and lying. There's all sorts of lying at this level. There's the lying of, I'm doing this for your own good. I'm going to tell you this for your own good. You know, I think you ought to make yourself more friendly to people. You know, people don't like you very much. And you should pay some attention to it. And I bought a book here. It's by a fellow by the name of I don't know what his name is. It's named after a library. This fellow will tell you all about how evil you are. I mean how you should act. I know it'd be a little bit hard on you. You've heard that kind of yak? Well, that is covert lying, which is one thing. The fellow is saying, yak, 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 over here, in an effort to convince somebody that he's telling the truth, when he's really saying, oh, what I wouldn't do to you if I just had the nerve. Of course, I'm a little bit scared of you, but I would never confess to this. But I'm going to cut you down to size, bud, if I get a chance, he's saying over here. You know, I really want to help you. It's too bad that people don't like you more. Covert hostility. That's down here in the band of fear. Now, what happens to a fellow who's very afraid, who just learns that he's going to lose his life? He's afraid anyhow. You suddenly tell him, well, we've got you all slated for the firing squad in the morning. Does he suddenly get, like they say he does in the novels, terrifically brave? Or does he weep? He weeps. And he'll go down into this next level. All right. But what about truth and weeping? You tell this fellow so-and-so, give him some news. He will tell you all sorts of reasons why he is weeping. But you get the most remarkable statements regarding his tears. You take a husband who has just been deserted or something of the sort. He will tell people the most confounded things that have happened to him, and vice versa. People are seeking sympathy, and that's what tears are for. They're a plea, a supplication for pity. They say, feel sorry for me, help me out. Because the individual at that level is defenseless, but he can still be salvaged. He wants help from the rest of the human race. So he cries. He pleads for sympathy, and he doesn't plead for it with truth. The most flagrant lying, if you want to check this over against your own reality and so forth, you know that the reasons for tears and the reasons why I want sympathy. You take the fellow who goes around and says, I have heart trouble. He doesn't have heart trouble. He's asking for sympathy. He's along a grief level. Down here along apathy, this guy not only doesn't tell the truth, you can't get him any registry of what truth is. He's completely careless about any fact. He's in apathy. He's careless about anything. He's practically dead, so it doesn't matter how he handles what. Truth, who cares? You walk up to him and ask him a few questions and so on. This is nowhere more apparent than in such a post as the interrogation of prisoners who are in apathy. An intelligence officer, boy, he can get more data off of prisoners. How many battleships did Japan build last month? 21. How many aircraft carriers are in the Bering? 59. Oh, you get some remarkable reports. You get some young officer who's out interrogating prisoners. Boy, he really comes back with stuff. So the handling of truth then becomes what you might call a gradient scale. Here's complete carelessness about it. This fellow doesn't care whether he handles truth or falsehood or anything. Here is a perversion in the direction of asking for sympathy. Here's a perversion to excuse fear. Here's another one to give reasons why one has to be angry. Here's one where the individual is asking for reasons. He's telling people that there are reasons why he's antagonistic and he's picking them out wrong. And here's, you get up here, you get truth, starts to ride way up here because the fellow's not afraid. He's perfectly happy. He hasn't an axe to grind about anything. He'll tell the truth unless he's postulating a future reality. And then watch out, because sometimes people down here don't realize that people up here do creative talking. All right. There is one column on your tone scale chart. One column. In such a way, human behavior can be invalidated, validated, extrapolated, turned upside down, inside out, examined, codified, lined up empirically, tested against individuals, and so forth. But this first extrapolation of what is the behavior of an individual in life and when faced with dangers, when this, that, and so on, what are these pattern behaviors? You find out they keep summing up to this list of things. You find out that this list of things sum up to death down here. Apathy is the closest thing to it. Above that is grief. Above that is fear of loss. Here's loss accomplished. Fear of loss. Angry to combat a loss that might take place. Antagonism toward a source that might occasion a loss. And we go on up the line until we get a high level of survival. All along the tone scale, any facet of human behavior can be so evaluated. As a matter of fact, when a person knows this subject very well, he doesn't need a chart. All he needs to know is the working principles of it, and he can extrapolate for his own use at any moment about what somebody here will do about anything. And he will know enough about it, about various things and observation, to know immediately when he's talking to a person who is fixedly and chronically here. But I will take up chronic position on the tone scale in the second half of the lecture. Let's take a brief.